When the other Indians fled, Running Elk waited. He watched as the white men left, seeing that one of the horses carried two men. He was sure that there had only been two men when the battle started. Someone else must have joined them during the night. That meant that there had never been more than three men against them. Three white men against 13 Indians, yet the white man prevailed. This was not a good sign. When Running Elk was certain the three white men were well gone, he went out to check on White Bull. His friend lay dead. Running Elk constructed a travois to take his childhood friend and recent rival home. Running Elk traveled for the rest of the day, then camped out that night. It seemed strange, lying on the ground, sleeping beside White Bull's body. Once, when they were children, they'd watched as an old man of the tribe was dressed in his finest clothes, then elevated onto a burial platform. White Bull reminded him that the old man was in the great beyond, where hunting was always good and there was always feasting. Running Elk always found the happy hunting ground to be a comforting thought for those who died. But when he went to the white man's school, he was told that there was no such thing as a happy hunting ground. He was told that only if one followed the white man's Jesus could one be saved, though he never quite understood what it meant to be saved. When Running Elk rode into the Crow village the next day, many came to see who was being pulled behind him on the travois. White Bull's mother saw the body.
Were you as mean to his horses?
No. Mean to his horses would not take us with him. So White Bull led a raiding party and was killed.
When he saw White Bull's mother put her hand on White Bull's face, he wanted to comfort her.
White Bull died very bravely.
I do not care that he died bravely. I did not want him to go. I feared when he left that this would happen.
Quiet Stream reached up to touch Running Elk's hand.
Are you going back to join Mean to his horses? Did you come back only to return White Bull's body?
I am not going back. I was wrong to leave. I will stay here with my people in peace.
Major Frederick Benteen held up his arm. The battalion, riding in columns of two, came to a halt.
Dismount!
Benteen and two troops of the 9th Cavalry had come up from Fort Keogh, reaching the Gray Bull River without seeing any hostile Indians. Within moments, Captain Pope and Lieutenant Bond, acting Sergeant Major Coltrane, and the two first sergeants approached Benteen.
We will bivouac here for the night. Troop commanders, get your sentries posted. First sergeants, see that the horses are cared for.
Yes, sir!
Return to your companies. Sergeant Major, you remain.
Benteen watched as the troop commanders and first sergeants returned to their units. Coltrane stood by in silence. Not until the men started unsaddling their horses and getting out their shelter halves did he speak.
Sergeant Major Coltrane, I understand you were at Willow Springs.
Yes, sir, I was.
Won't you tell me about it?
Not much to tell, Major. There were 30 of us. We were well mounted and armed, but Sergeant Winston and I were the only two veterans. I was a corporal then. The rest were all raw recruits. And we were taking them to Fort Shaw for training. We just stopped for lunch when we were attacked by 60 to 70 Lakota. With the opening shots, 10 of the recruits threw down their weapons and ran. It was such a damn fool thing for them to do. The Indians had sport with them. Running them down easily, then clubbing them, or running them through with lances. The rest of the men stayed, whether because they knew it was the right thing to do or because they saw what happened to the ones who ran, I don't know. But they stayed, and we formed a circle. Some of the men, despite being raw recruits, were pretty good shots. We held the Indians off for the rest of the day, though we had 3 more killed and another 8 wounded. Come nighttime, we pulled out, but we ran into the Indians at least 3 more times during the night. Exchanged fire with them every time. Sergeant Winston was killed during one of the nighttime fights. Finally, we reached Fort Shaw just before dawn, bringing our wounded with us. But in all, We lost 14 killed.
And what were the Indian casualties?
Yes, sir, I knew that's where you were going with this. The next day, a reconnaissance in force retraced our route. They brought back all of our dead. All of them had been scalped and mutilated, but they did not find any Indian bodies. So the official report says that there were no Indian casualties at all.
Is that true?
No, sir, it isn't true. I personally saw 9 Indians killed, and that was just on my side of the defensive circle. Winston told me he saw as many himself, though some of them might have been the same ones I saw. But without any proof, the official report remained. No Indians killed.
No Indians killed.
That was the report, yes, sir.
You may wonder why I asked you about this. I asked you about it because many of the officers and the men of the 6th Cavalry have taken great delight in telling me that story. I use it to point out that nearly half of your platoon ran at first contact and that the rest of the men did nothing more but hold on until they could run away come nightfall. All that, not one Indian killed. It's proof, they say, that colored soldiers can't be depended on in a fight. I wanted to hear it from your own lips.
Major, as God is my witness, I have told you the truth. I can only guess at how many Indians were killed, but I know there were at least 15 or more.
Which is nearly as many men as you lost.
Yes, sir. But considerably less than Custer lost.
Benteen blinked a couple of times. Then he nodded. You're right about that, Sergeant Major. You are right about that. And if it's any consolation to you, I do believe you. What is the mood of the troopers?
It's very good, Major. Many have been in battle before, and the ones who have not been in battle are looking forward to it. And, Major, if you don't mind my saying so, they feel good because you are our commanding officer. Even the rawest recruit knows that there is no one in the Army with more experience than you.
Well, that may be true, Sergeant Major. But not all my experiences have been positive ones. When Major Benteen brought the 9th Cavalry into Damaris Springs, the townspeople turned out to welcome them. The soldiers rode in close formation. As they passed the mayor's office, the guidon bearers dipped their colors.
Eyes right!
The soldiers in every file except the extreme right file turned their eyes right in salute. Regret studied the troopers.
Damn! They're all colored!
All the better.
Why all the better?
Because they won't have enough sense to figure out that we're the ones that started all the trouble.
Yeah, that's right, ain't it?
The mayor is holding another meeting tonight, and he's invited the officers.
Colored? Coming to a town meeting? How's the rest of the town going to take that?
The officers are white.
Oh, well, then I reckon that'll be all right.
At the Rocking Bee Ranch, Clayton lay in bed now, with fresh bandages on the wound on his side and wrapped around his arm. His daughter Diane sat on the bed beside him. Mrs. Clayton, Falcon, Cody, and Ingram stood around the bed.
I can't thank you enough for bringing my husband home safely.
He and Mr. Bowman had a lot to do with it themselves, Mrs. Clayton. Don't forget, they held the Indians off for 24 hours.
Oh, thanks to Oliver. I know what an ordeal he went through to find help. But what I can understand is why the Indians suddenly gone bad. We've lived here for 10 years without the slightest bit of trouble. In fact, we've had Indian guests in our home.
I've dealt with Indians for most of my life, and the most important thing I have learned is that they are always unpredictable. A mountain man acquaintance of mine once described them as notional.
They're having a town meeting tonight in Damaris Springs. And do you plan to go?
Yeah, I think we need to.
I heard that they brought in the cavalry. Oh, I'm glad. I hate it that it has come to this, but since it has, I feel safer knowing that the cavalry has been called in.
When your men go to that meeting in town, give them my regrets for not being there.
I'm sure they'll understand. Once again, the citizens of Damaris Springs gathered in the town hall for a meeting called by Mayor Joe Cravens. As before, Pierre Bellefontaine sat at the head table with the mayor, but joining him tonight was Major Benteen. Falcon, Cody, and Prentice Ingram sat once more in the front row. And though Clayton had been unable to attend due to his wounds, Oliver Bowman, still showing the effects of his ordeal, was present.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are met again to discuss the Indian problem. In a few minutes, I'm going to call on Mr. Oliver Bowman to give us a first-hand report of his experience with the Indians. But first, I want to introduce Major Benteen and his gallant officers. Would you gentlemen stand, please?
Benteen and his officers stood to acknowledge the applause.
Major Benteen and his soldiers are camped out on Stinking Water River, some west of here. I know that'll make you feel better to realize that they are between us and the Crow Village.
If all the officers are here, who's in charge of the soldiers right now?
Sergeant Major Coltrane is in charge at the moment.
I hear all your soldiers is colored. Is this fella Coltrane a colored man as well?
He is.
Well, what if the Indians decide to attack tonight while you and all your officers are here? Do you think it's safe to leave a colored man in charge?
Sergeant Major Coltrane would be quite capable of mounting a defense if it became necessary.
What I want to know is, when are you going to go out to that village and clean it out?
And just what village would that be?
Hell, you know what village! She talking about that nest of crows that's between here and Yellowstone.
I don't believe that the crow are our enemy.
What do you mean they ain't our enemy? Didn't they kill the Barlow family? Air last one of them?
Indians may have killed the Barlow family.
What do you mean, may have killed them? If you had seen them strapped to boards in front of the hardware store, you wouldn't have said may have. They was all butchered up exactly the way Indians do it.
Even if it was Indians who killed them, there is no proof that it was Crow. And even if it was Crow Indians, chances are that it was no more than one or two renegades. I just do not believe that the Crow are our enemy.
Then who is? Sioux?
More than likely, it's Mean to his horses and a few renegades, mostly Cheyenne. Though I am willing to admit that he may have attracted Indians from some of the other bands as well.
So what do you plan to do about it?
Our first duty is to provide safety for the town of Damaris Springs.
The best way you could do that is to go after the Indians and take care of them.
I agree. It is my intention to establish a very aggressive pattern of scouting. Now, if we find armed Indians wandering off the reservations, we'll deal with them.
You're making a mistake. The first thing you should do is attack the Crow Indian village near Yellowstone. Run them completely out of here, back up into Montana somewhere. Then, with that taken care of, you can start your scouting.
Thank you, Mr. Bellefontaine. But I'm in command, and I will conduct the military operation as I see fit.
After the meeting broke up, Benteen invited Falcon, Cody, and Ingram to the bivouac area of his two companies. There, they had dinner together, and Benteen discussed his plans with them.
I intend to send out a couple of scouts in strength. I shall want one element to go down to the Gray Bull River and then follow it up to the Bighorn River. The other group will follow the Stinking Water River up to the Bighorn. Colonel Cody, if you would, I'd like you to act as guide for the men who will take the Gray Bull Scout. And Colonel McAllister, if you are agreeable to it, I'd like you to act as guide for the group that will take the Stinking Water River Scout. Proceed to the Bighorn, then go south until you effect a rendezvous with Colonel Cody, who'll be coming north. If for some reason you do not effect the rendezvous, then that will probably mean that the other detail is engaged, in which case I want you to continue on until you do make contact.
All right.
Colonel McAllister, I'll send Sergeant Major Coltrane with you. Colonel Cody, Lieutenant Bond will be with you.
Very good.
I will flip a coin to see which one of you I will accompany.
I'm not sure having a civilian along is such a good idea. I don't want any of my men to be distracted by having to look out for you.
Major, I will speak for Mr. Ingram. He has been in battle all over the world. He's more likely to be looking out for the soldiers than to have one of them looking out for him.
Very well. You say so.
Ingram flipped the coin, then he looked at Falcon and smiled.
Oh, breathe easy. I'm going with Cody.
Well, aren't I the lucky one?
Gentlemen, I see no reason for delay. I'm going to instruct Bond and Coltrane to put together their scout immediately. I think 20 men each will be sufficient. If you encounter an Indian force larger than that, don't engage. Keep an eye on them. Send one courier back here and another to the other scout platoon.
That way, we can strike them with maximum force. After the meeting, Bellefontaine met Sam Davis and Lee Regret in his office.
This isn't working out the way it was supposed to. If the soldiers don't drive the Crow out of their village, we haven't accomplished anything.
Seemed to me like none of the folks in town was all that happy about the way things is turning out either.
No, they weren't very happy about it, were they? Davis, those men who were with you when you attacked the Indians a couple of weeks ago, do you think you could get them to go with you to attack the village?
Whoa, now, Mr. Bellefontaine. There was only 6 of us done that. That ain't near enough to attack a whole village.
You wouldn't need too many if you attacked in the middle of the night, when they're asleep.
Even then, we'd need more than 6.
What about 20? Would that be enough if you attacked the village in the middle of the night, when nobody was expecting it?
20 might do it, but I'm not sure I can come up with 20 men.
If I paid them $100 apiece, and $200 to each of you?
Oh, yeah. For $100 apiece, I can get 20 men for sure.
Falcon and Coltrane's platoon had come 20 miles up the Stinking Water River when they reached South Fork. Here, the water widened considerably to accommodate the 2 streams, and the men dismounted with the intention of having their lunch. The horses were watered, then ground tethered in the grass so they could feed as well.
Indians!
There were no more than 6 Indians, but their yelling, whooping, and firing guns frightened the cavalry horses, causing them to pull away from their ground tethers and run away. Sergeant Major Coltrane and the others fired at the Indians, and the attackers retreated. The soldiers stood there, holding smoking weapons in their hands, watching as the Indians rode away.
What will we do now, Sarge? All our horses are gone.
We're going to go get them.
Within 15 minutes, 6 the horses were retrieved, and the men were about to get mounted to go after the remaining horses when the Indians returned. This time, there were at least 200 of them, against Falcon, Coltrane, and no more than 20 soldiers.
To the river! Circle up on the island!
The cavalrymen had no choice but to retreat onto an island in the middle of the river. There, they formed a defensive circle, the soldiers lying belly down on the ground while Falcon and Coltrane were on their knees inside the circle. Within the first 5 minutes, all of the recovered horses were killed, along with one of the soldiers. Sergeant Major Coltrane had been hit twice, once in the right thigh and once in the left leg. But though Indians fired volley after volley, the soldiers returned fire. And because they were in the prone position and the Indians were exposed, the soldiers got the better of it. When Mean to his horses pulled his Indians back, he left almost 50 of them behind, dead in the water or along the banks of the river.
They're gone.
Coltrane grimaced.
Not for long.
How bad are your wounds, Sergeant Major?
I can't write to tell. I guess you're gonna have to take a look and let me know.
Falcon used his knife to cut open Coltrane's trousers so he could look at the wounds.
Well, the one on your thigh isn't that bad. Looks like it just caught the edge of it. Left a crease, but there's no bullet.
The other one?
It didn't hit a bone, and it didn't sever any artery that would cause you to lose a lot of blood. The bullet is still inside, so it's gonna need to come out.
I think you can get it out.
I think I can try.
6 later, Falcon held up the bullet to show it. Then, he found the cleanest piece of cloth he could find and he bound up Coltrane's wounds.
Oh. Yeah, there. That should hold you for a bit.
He had no sooner finished with Coltrane than the Indians attacked again. And again, the casualties among the Indians were very high. Cavalry suffered casualties as well, and because their numbers were so small, each loss was multiplied in its effect. 3 more soldiers were killed, and 1 more wounded. The Indians made another charge, but again they were repulsed. But not without cost, as 2 more soldiers were killed and 2 more were wounded. After that, it turned into a waiting game. Now there were only 15 soldiers left alive, 4 of whom were wounded. The nature of the wounds ranged from slight to serious. Mean to his horses changed his tactics. Realizing he had the soldiers trapped on the island, he decided he could wait them out. He put his men on both sides of the island to deny the soldiers any opportunity to escape.
Sergeant, the Indians are all around us. We're trapped here.
Look out there, Shula.
Coltrane pointed to the river and the riverbank. They were strewn with bodies.
What do you see?
I see Indians.
Dead Indians. We've killed nearly 100 of them now.
Yeah. We have, ain't we?
Old Mean to his horses has already decided that he can't run us off this island, so he plans to try and wait us out. Only, he can't do that either.
How come he can't?
We have plenty of ammunition, we have water, and we have 15 days of rations. And if we had to, we can cut up one of the dead horses and cook it. But we aren't gonna have to wait here 15 days, because by then, Lieutenant Bond will connect with us.
Yeah. That's right.
Coltrane turned to Falcon.
How's Jackson?
I don't think he's gonna make it.
Jackson's a good soldier.
Sergeant, from what I've observed, they're all good soldiers.
Thank you, Colonel. Coming from you, it means a lot.
That night, two of the men volunteered to try and sneak through the Indians to go for help. They were seen by the Indians and had returned to the island. Meanwhile, Bellefontaine personally led the group he called the Wyoming Citizens Militia to the Crow Village on the Meteetse River. It was 2 o'clock in the morning as the men quietly forded the river. As Bellefontaine had said, no one in the village expected anything. High Hawk, perhaps to show the loyalty of the Crow, was flying an American flag over his teepee.
Look at that. That Indian bastard is flying an American flag. Where do you reckon he got that?
More than likely, he stole it from some soldiers he killed somewhere.
That son of a bitch has some nerve.
What are we gonna do?
We're going to kill as many as we can. That's what we're going to do.
Suddenly, a horse of one of the militiamen struck a metal bucket lying on the bank of the river. In her teepee, Quiet Stream heard the sound, and she opened her eyes. Not sure if it was something she'd actually heard or whether it was something she'd dreamed, she just lay there in the dark for a moment longer, drifting comfortably in that zone between sleep and wake. Then she heard another sound. This time it was the sound of shod horses' hooves striking rocks. None of the villagers' horses were shod.
Father, there are white men in the camp.
Big Hand sat up and listened. Like Quiet Stream, he heard the sound of shod hooves on stone. He grabbed his rifle and then stepped through the opening of the teepee.
Village awake! Village awake! White men are in camp!
Kill that screaming son of a bitch!
Big Hand fell. Even his other warriors, heeding his call, were beginning to appear outside. Bellefontaine's men began shooting at everyone they saw, men, women, children. When they didn't have a specific target, they fired into the teepee. They also began setting fire to the teepee.
Wait! Wait! You are making a mistake! These people are innocent! I'm the one you want! I was with Mean to his horses!
Despite the fact that he was calling attention to himself, Running Elk was not hit, even though the bullets flew all around him. But though he was spared, he saw his mother, father, and young sister killed, along with dozens of other villagers. Running Elk had come out without a weapon, hoping that by doing so he could surrender and spare the other villagers. Now he realized that his plan was not going to work. Davis, in regret, caught up in a personal killing frenzy, killed and scalped 3 women and 5 children who had surrendered and were begging for mercy. Following their example, the other members of the militia went on a bloodlust rampage of their own, killing all the wounded they could find before mutilating and scalping the dead, including pregnant women, children, and babies. They also started plundering the teepees that had not yet been burned, dividing up the spoil.
Quiet Stream! No!
Running Elk ran and dropped down beside Quiet Stream. She had been hit by at least 3 bullets, and there was blood from her shoulders to her waist.
Quiet Stream. Quiet Stream.
I will always.
Running Elk looked around him, and seeing a war club in the hands of a nearby dead warrior, he grabbed the club. Then he turned to look toward the white men who had come into the village on their killing spree. He ran toward one of the invaders. Reaching up, he pulled the white man from his saddle and crushed his skull with one blow of the heavy war club. Running Oak leaped into the empty saddle then, and with his war club held high, he urged the horse in pursuit of another of the invaders. One blow brought down another invader, and then another as well. So far, Running Elk had managed to kill three men, and he was sending panic through the others. Bellefontaine pointed toward Running Elk.
Kill that Indian! $100 to the man who kills him!
At least five men turned their guns toward Running Elk. Though Bellefontaine didn't know if all five rounds struck Running Elk, it didn't matter, because he saw blood, bone, and brain detritus erupt from the Indian's head. He knew that that wild warrior was dead. With Running Elk lying dead on the ground, the shooting stopped. For a long moment, the mounted white men fought to control their horses as they looked around the village, now fairly well lit by the burning teepees. Everywhere they looked, they saw dead bodies. Bodies of the old men, including High Hawk, as well as bodies of women and children. High Hawk was wrapped in the American flag, perhaps believing that that would have saved him. Now, with their last resistance eliminated, Bellefontaine's men began to systematically scalp and mutilate the dead. As many as 150 Indians lay dead, most of whom were old men, women, and children. Bellefontaine lost only four men, three of whom had been killed by Running Elk. Back on the island the next morning, the Indians renewed hostilities. Again, Mean to His Horses sent his men and attacked against Falcon, Coltrane, and the Buffalo soldiers defending their position on the island. And again, the attack resulted in high cost to the Indians, this time inflicting no additional casualties among the soldiers. Then, at mid-morning, Mean to His Horses tried a new tactic. He had two of his men bring forth a captive, and they stood just on the bank of the river so the captive could be seen. The captive was clearly a white man, a soldier in uniform.
What the hell? What is he doing there?
You know him?
Yes, sir, I know him, sir. It's Sergeant Deepro, but he's supposed to be back at Fort Keogh. I have no idea what he's doing here.
Mean to His Horses rode up behind Deepro.
Buffalo soldiers! Leave your guns and go away. I will let you live and I will send the white-eyed soldier with you. If you do not leave your guns and go away, I will kill the white-eyed soldier. And his death will not be swift.
Deepro! Deepro! What are you doing there?
Sergeant Coltrane, is that you? Don't let me die, Coltrane. Me and you's friends, ain't we? We soldiered together. Don't let me die.
Is that man a friend of yours?
He's a long way from being a friend. But he is a soldier, so it doesn't matter whether he's a friend or not.
Who's your best shot?
Well, sir, I don't mean to brag, but that would be me.
All right.
Falcon turned to speak to the remaining soldiers.
Ben, Sergeant Major Coltrane and I are going to take out the two Indians who are holding Deepro. I want all of you to pick out one of the other Indians as a target. As soon as we fire, you fire in volley. If we can take down seven or eight of them all at the same time, the rest of them are likely going to pull back. And that will give Deepro a chance to come across the river.
The soldiers all nodded. Then they got into position, and each one of them picked out a target.
Sergeant Major Coltrane, you take the one on the left. I have the one on the right.
What about Mean to His Horses?
He's sitting up on his horse, thinking he's in command. I'm shooting a Winchester, and as soon as we kill the two who are holding Deepro, I'll re-chamber around and kill Mean to His Horses.
Damn if it ain't worth getting shot a couple of times just so I can see the expression on old Mean to His Horses' face when he realizes what's happened.
Take aim.
Falcon raised the rifle to his shoulder.
I'll count to three.
You ready, man?
Coltrane raised the carbine to his shoulder.
One, two, three.
Falcon and Coltrane fired at the same time, their shots followed almost immediately by the rest of the soldiers. The two Indians who were holding Deep Pro fell, as did six more. Mean to his horses was totally shocked, and for just a second he looked on in disbelief. Then quickly, he realized what had happened, and he turned his own horse to gallop away, but it was too late. Mean to his horses fell from the saddle. Depro was just as shocked as Mean to his horses had been, and he was still standing in place.
Depro, run! Come over here to us!
Depro started across the water toward the island, and as he did so, the remaining men of Coltrane's platoon fired a second volley to keep the Indians back. As Depro reached the island, Schuller reached up and pulled him down to safety.
Thank you. Thank you. I thought I was gone for sure.
What were you doing with them, Sergeant Depro? Thought you were back at Fort Keogh.
I had to go back. I couldn't leave the wagon.
You couldn't leave the wagon? What wagon? Leave it where?
Sarge, someone is coming.
Get ready, men.
Once again, the men got into position to repel an attack. As the mass of warriors grew closer, they could be seen riding in columns of twos. Then the troopers saw the red and white guidon fluttering at the head of the column.
Sarge, it's Lieutenant Bond and our men!
The scouting parties returned with the wounded and dead to the 9th Cavalry bivouac area. One of the wounded, Private Travis Jackson, died before they could get him back. The remaining wounded were treated by Dr. Urban, who was brought from town by Benteen just for that cause.
Sergeant Major Coltrane.
Yes, Schuller, what is it?
I think maybe you better come look at the guns.
What guns?
The guns we picked up at the island. The guns the Indians was using.
What about them, Schuller? Why are you talking that way?
I just think you'd better take a look at them.
The Sergeant Major did as Schuller suggested, and soon he stood at the entrance to the command tent.
Major Benteen, sir. Permission to enter, sir.
Of course you can come in, Sergeant Major.
Thank you, sir.
Would you grab a stool, join us? We were just having coffee and a discussion about you.
About me, sir?
I'm putting you in for the Medal of Honor.
Medal of... Well, sir. Well, now. Yes, sir, that would be quite an honor. Especially since I don't feel I did anything to earn it.
Colonel McAllister does, and I set quite a store in what he has to say.
Colonel, I appreciate the kind words.
Now then, Sergeant Major, you wanted to see me?
Yes, sir. After the fight, several of the men went out onto the battlefield and began gathering up the guns the Indians was using. I thought they was all armed awfully well, and now I know why.
Why?
Coltrane pulled a little piece of paper from his pocket.
Here are the serial numbers of three of the rifles. 410543, 410275, 410221.
He looked up at Benteen.
The fact is, Major, every weapon we picked up started with the numbers 410. I just read these three because Privates Wright, Dunaway, and Carnes recognized them. They are the same carbines they were carrying before we got the new issue, and was told to turn them in. And seeing as I made out all the inventories, I remember that all the carbines started with the numbers 410.
What are you saying, Sergeant Major? Are you suggesting that somehow the Indians managed to get their hands on our old weapons?
Not just somehow. I know how they got them.
How?
Depro.
Depro?
Yes, sir.
Benteen got up from his stool and walked over to the entrance. The three soldiers Coltrane had mentioned were standing there just outside the tent, in case they were needed to validate the weapons as having belonged to them. Benteen believed Coltrane. He needed no validation, but he did need something else.
Men, find Sergeant Depro and bring him here to me.
Yes, sir.
Under arrest.
Yes, sir.
In shackles.
Yes, sir!
I should have listened to you in the beginning, Sergeant Major. You suspected he had stolen the weapons when they disappeared from the arms room, didn't you?
Yes, sir, but all it was me thinking it. I didn't have any proof.
Well, you do now.
At that moment, Private Dunaway returned.
Begging the Major's pardon, sir. Sergeant Depro ain't nowhere around, sir. Trooper Washington said he seen him leave, going toward town.
Benteen turned to Falcon, Cody, and Ingram.
Gentlemen, Would you like to go into town with me?
Falcon and the others rode into town for the express purpose of finding and placing under arrest Sergeant Lucas Depro. But when they got to town, the reaction of the townspeople was such that they put Depro aside. The town was in major celebration mode, with fireworks exploding and a general attitude of giddiness.
What's going on?
Ain't you heard? The engine's been whooped!
Fantine turned to Falcon.
Are you talking about your fight at the island? How'd they find out so fast?
Paper! Paper! Get your paper here! Extra! Read all about it! Indian village! Wiped out!
Indian village? Damn. Somehow I don't think they're talking about the island fight.
Ingram dismounted. Then he went over to the paper boy and bought four papers, one for each of them.
Extra! Big Indian battle! Marvelous victory! Many Indians killed to but three militiamen killed. Our own brave militia conducted a surprise raid against the Crow village on the Metitsi River last night. The results of the attack were so successful that your humble publisher has seen fit to print this, an extra issue, in order to place all the glorious details of the battle before the eyes of the public. The attack was carried out by the Wyoming Civilian Militia, organized just for this purpose. In a brilliantly conceived tactical operation, Colonel Pierre Bellefontaine led but 20 men in an attack against 300 or more armed and wily heathens. Striking in the night, the Wyoming Civilian Militia brought terror into the hearts of the selfsame savages who had but so recently brought terror into the hearts of the hapless white people whom they have so cruelly ravaged in their numerous debaucheries against innocent farmers, ranchers, and homesteaders. Unwilling to surrender, the savages put up a fierce fight. Bullets whistled through the night air in their deadly transit as they sought their targets. For hours the battle raged, with the Indians' terrible screams and war cries rending the air as if the howls came from all the banshees of hell. But through it all, our brave militiamen stood their ground, often fighting hand to hand against numbers far superior to their own. Finally, as dawn broke, the village stood quiet and empty, its inhabitants having either fled or now lying dead on the ground. Huzzas for Colonel Bellefontaine and his brave militiamen. Plans are now underway to hold a town dance in their honor. All are invited, where we are told souvenirs and booty taken from the village will be on display.
Son of a bitch.
Falcon, Cody, and Ingram picked their way through the bodies and residue of the Indian encampment. There were many more women and children than there were warriors. Like the warriors, the women and children had been scalped and mutilated. They found one pregnant woman with her stomach sliced open, with the dead baby half in and half out of her womb. Cody had been a guest here in this very camp many times.
That's Gray Antelope. There's Howling Wolf.
He saw a young woman with the top of her head gone. There were two children lying beside her, and the children had also been scalped.
This is white, dear. And her children.
Cody saw the one Indian wrapped in an American flag.
My God, that's Iowok. 5 years ago, I introduced him to President Chester Arthur, who gave him that flag.
I can't believe the people of Damaris Springs actually regard this as a great victory. This was nothing more than a slaughter.
Oh, they know only what they read in the newspaper.
Someone should tell the true story.
Well, there's only one of us who's an experienced writer.
Yes, but after what the newspaper published in an extra declaring this to be a great victory, the editor may not be interested in publishing what I would write.
It depends on what the owner of the newspaper tells him to publish.
What are you saying? That the newspaper editor doesn't own the paper?
No, he doesn't, Way. I loaned him the money to start the newspaper, with the idea that when my town is built, he would move the paper to Cody. He's 1 year in arrears in repayment of the loan. I believe that if I would mark the loan as paid in full, he would be most amenable to publishing the truth.
Well, that paper did publish a series of articles by Ingram, recounting the depravity of the militia raid on the Crow village and the heroism of the 9th Cavalry's battle in the river. The revelations resulted in the cancellation of the militia dance, as well as the mounting of a parade and town celebration to honor the soldiers of the 9th Cavalry. The search continued for the missing Sergeant Depro. Now, although Madame Mouchette advertised her establishment as a place where gentlemen could engage and stimulate in conversation with well-mannered and attractive young ladies, it was a whorehouse, pure and simple, and everyone in town knew it. At the moment, Sam Davis and Sergeant Lucas Depro stood in the lobby of that house, waiting for Lee Regret, who was upstairs with one of the well-mannered and attractive young ladies. Both Davis and Depro had concluded their stimulating conversations, and they were reading the latest copy of the Damaris Springs newspaper. Davis nudged Depro.
Hey, Depro, have you read this? They're saying what happened out at the village was a massacre of Injuns. Bellefontaine ain't gonna like this. He ain't gonna like it that they're calling it a massacre.
Well, that's what you done, ain't it?
Maybe so. But there ain't no call to put something like that in the newspaper. It's Cody and McAllister that's causing all the trouble. What's a minion?
What?
It says here that Cody and McAllister are going to see to it that Bellefontaine and his minions will be brought to justice. What's a minion?
Hell's fire, I don't know.
I don't know either. Whatever it is, it probably ain't good.
Let me see that. Son of a bitch. Davis, did you tell anybody I'm the one that sold them guns?
No. Why would I do that?
It says here that they know I'm the one that sold the guns to the Indians. Only it wasn't just me, damn it. It was me and you and Regret. And I ain't planning on taking all the blame my own self.
Regret was still packing his shirt tail down in his pants as he came down the stairs to join Sam Davis and Lucas Depro, who were both waiting in the lobby. Depro was no longer wearing a uniform.
Have you heard?
Have I heard?
Have I heard what?
Keep your voice down. There ain't gonna be no dance. Instead, they're having a parade and a town picnic today.
Well, hell, that's as good as a dance, I reckon.
I said keep your voice down, because there's more to it. The picnic ain't for us. It's for the damn colored soldiers. And the reason they canceled the dance is because the coloreds couldn't come on account of they ain't gonna let the coloreds dance with the white women. And now, they're planning on celebrating the coloreds killing mean to his horses.
Well, I don't...
Pipe down! Damn it!
I don't see why they couldn't have a picnic for the coloreds and go ahead and have that dance for us. That way, we could go to both of them.
Ain't gonna be nothing for us. Except to maybe jail if Cody and McAllister have their way.
What are you talking about?
Read this.
You know I can't read.
I forgot. What it says is that Cody and McAllister went out to the Injun village to have a look around, and now they're telling the whole country that what we done was just murder a bunch of Injun women and children.
How can you murder an Injun? Ain't that pretty much like stepping on a bug or something? It ain't like they was white or anything. I ain't never heard of no one getting in trouble for killing an Injun.
There's more. They know that me and you and Depro sold the guns to the Injuns.
What?
How the hell do they know that?
I don't know. I don't know, but it don't matter none how they know. The point is, they know.
We need to get out of here.
It won't do no good to run. It won't make no difference where we go. I know both McAllister and Cody, and believe me, them two can track a fish through water and a bird through the air. If they're alive, they'll find us.
If they're alive.
What?
You said, if they're alive. Seems to me like you just come up with the answer. If they're alive, they'll find us. If they're dead, they won't. So the smartest thing we can do is kill them before we leave. That way we can go somewhere else and not worry about being found.
Yeah, well, killing them ain't gonna be that easy. Like I said, I know them too.
Besides which, we ain't got enough money to go anywhere in the first place.
Don't worry about the money. We'll get it.
How we gonna get any money? You plan on robbing a bank or something? Because I ain't gonna do that. A man can get himself killed doing something like that.
We'll get it from Bellefontaine. He owes us.
Maybe he owes the two of you, but he don't owe me nothing.
Sure he does. When you got them guns from the army, you was doing that for Bellefontaine.
Yeah, I was, wasn't I?
Davis, Regret, and D-Pro stood across the desk from Bellefontaine in the big man's office.
You are mistaken, gentlemen. I don't owe you anything. If you wish to run, feel free to do so. But I have no intention of leaving. Not now. Not when I have everything going just the way I want it to go.
Davis could not believe his ears.
You ain't got nothing going the way you want it to go. Didn't you hear what I just said? The paper says what we done out at that village was a massacre.
There are those who said the same thing about Shivington at Sand Creek and about Custer at Washita. But today, Shivington is still a respected man in Colorado, and no one is more honored than Custer. I have no intention of letting a negative newspaper article change my plans.
Yeah, well, maybe that works for you. But it's different with Davis, Regret, and me. We sold guns to the Indians. If they catch us, we're going to jail for that.
Then, gentlemen, I suggest you start running.
Yeah, that's what we're gonna do. As soon as you give us enough money to get out of here.
And how much do you consider to be enough money?
I'd say about $1,000 apiece.
$1,000 apiece? You must think I'm a fool. Get out of here. You're on your own.
You can't turn your back on us now. Not after all we've done for you.
Davis drew his pistol. Then he pointed it toward the safe that sat against the back wall.
Open that safe and take out your money. We would have been satisfied with $1,000 apiece. Now we want all of it.
You're making a mistake.
Not as big a mistake as you just made. Now, open that safe like I told you to.
Bellefontaine walked over to the safe.
What makes you think I have that much money in this safe?
It don't matter to me how much money you have. However much it is, we're going to take it all.
Bellefontaine opened the safe and stuck his hand inside. Then he spun around with a pistol in his hand.
You didn't really think I was going to let you steal my money, did you?
But though he was quick, Davis was quicker. He pulled the trigger, and the bullet from his gun hit Bellefontaine in the forehead.
See how much money he has in there, D-Pro.
D-Pro looked into the safe, smiling broadly. The sergeant stuck both hands in and turned back toward the others with both hands filled with money.
Look at this! There must be $10,000 or $20,000 here!
Davis looked at Bellefontaine's body.
The dumb son of a bitch should have given us the money. All we was asking for was $1,000 apiece.
Quickly, the three men began taking money out of the safe and stuffing it down into their clothes. A year later, Prentice Ingram's book, McAllister and Cody, Heroes of the Western Plains, rolled off the presses to wide distribution.
Before we come to the conclusion of this factual story of the adventures of Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody, I believe it would serve the reader well if a perfect picture could be summoned from my imperfect words, by which the reader could visualize the appearance of Falcon McAllister on the day of the events to be here described. Falcon McAllister is a plainsman in every sense of the word, yet unlike any other of his class. He is north of 6 feet in height, and looks even taller due to his bearing. He has broad shoulders, well-formed chest and limbs, a face that, though cured by exposure to wind, sun, rain, and cold, is nevertheless considered handsome by every woman who has ever made the observation. Whether mounted or afoot, Falcon McAllister is one of the most perfect specimens of manhood one might ever see. Of his courage, there can be no question, for it has been tested far too often for there to be any doubt. His skill in the use of the pistol and rifle is unerring, while his deportment is entirely free from all bluster or bravado. He is anything but a quarrelsome man, yet he has been involved in innumerable conflicts, always instigated by another party. On the day of the parade and picnic in Damaris Springs, and while celebrating the victory over Mean to His Horses, extensively written about in a previous chapter of this book, Falcon McAllister came up against the desperados, Sam Davis, Lee Regret, and Lucas D-Pro. Without regard to the safety of the innocent men, women, and children of Damaris Springs, the three brigands began firing at Falcon McAllister with the intention of killing him.
McAllister! You have drawn your last breath.
For my friends and I have come to lay you in your grave.
It is not I who will die this day, but you. For I am armed with the power of right.
As he addressed the villainous three, he drew his pistol, and with but three shots, killed the men who would have killed him. And with their demise, this story of Falcon McAllister and Buffalo Bill Cody, a factual account more thrilling and exciting than anything I have written of the two of them before, despite that it is true, comes to an end. Buffalo Bill has returned to tour with his exhibition, and Falcon, though earnestly invited to be a part of the show, declined. As of this writing, Falcon McAllister continues to live in the wind, and his destiny now, as it ever shall be, is danger.
Well, now, it sort of went like that. Falcon did put those three in the ground, although with no audible speechifying that anyone could lay mention to later on in the saloon, and Buffalo Bill returned to his show. And Falcon, well now, I don't know about that living in the wind stuff or danger as his destiny, but I do know he lived to fight another day.
Eagle 16, Massacre of Eagles is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2011, William W. Johnstone. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Mort Shelby, David Coyne, Christopher Sheeran, Gregory Gordon, Michael John Casey, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, James Keegan, Joe Brack, Tim Getman, Michael Glenn, Richard Rowan, Christopher Graybill, James Lewis, Tony Nam, James Konacek, Eric Messner, Colleen Delaney, Terrence Aselford, Ken Jackson, Nick DePinto, Dylan Lynch, Nanette Savard, Alyssa Wilmoth, Johan Detweiler, Yasmin Toison, Ren Casey, and Julianne Elliott. Directed by Rose Elizabeth Supan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Nathaniel Perry. Additional music by Johan Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Rose Elizabeth Supan. If you enjoyed Massacre of Eagles, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com. And be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen the Mountain Man, Preacher the First Mountain Man, and Matt Jensen the Last Mountain Man. All available in graphic audio at Roadstops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
Where'd he get him?
Before he passed out. Hurley said he got him twice. Once in the leg and once in the neck.
When Smoke's friend and longtime foreman Pearly is bitten by a deadly mountain rattler, Smoke must venture into a dodgy gold rush city known as Payday.
What's wrong with your friend? He shot or something?
No, he's been snake bit real bad. We came here looking for a doctor.
The nearest real doctor's up in Pueblo, about 50 miles from here.
Damn.
I bet we do got us a dentist, and he takes care of most of our doctoring when we need it.
But when Smoke gets Pearly the only aid he can find, he crosses paths with someone from his past. Someone hell-bent on revenge.
How long you gonna let this Jensen thing distract you, Buck? Every day you sit around here messing around with this Pearly character trying to get to Jensen, we're losing money.
I'm gonna do whatever it takes to first make Jensen's life a living hell, Jeb, and then I'm gonna kill him. If you don't like it, there ain't nothing you can do about it.
But the only thing this oily varmint didn't count on was Smoke Jensen's boiling, unstoppable wrath.
Now, I don't know what you have against me, Tolliver, or why you've gone to so much trouble to hurt my friend, but I'll find out sooner or later, and we'll have a reckoning, you and me. You do know, don't you, Buck, that only one of us is leaving this town alive.
The streets run red in the Mountain Man number 32, Wrath of the Mountain Man.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.